Thanks. So, the first bit, we just had that last little stuff to touch up on Rule 59, which is new trial, and all we had was those additional grounds. We did everything else. But just a refresher recollection, what we're talking about is someone moving for a new trial after the judgment's entered and it's been entered against them. A lot of times they file alternatively with the other motion. Judgment is a matter of law. They're hoping to win in their favor to get it reversed and put in their favor. But often they don't get that, so they want at least a new trial. That this is where the court's actually weighing the evidence. If you have an evidentiary challenge, there's no inferences drawn in favor of the verdict because the ultimate conclusion is not we're going to undo what the jury did, but rather get you a new start with a new jury. So the standard is still very high against the great weight of the evidence. What that means is the judge can't just say, hey, I think you got this wrong. I would have decided it differently if I was sitting on the jury with you. It's more of, we've looked at everything and it's so far against what any kind of reasonable inference would allow us to draw. But not so far against that we think you should automatically win, just to get a new trial. So that leaves us with excessive damages, process, and new evidence. I have just a couple clicker questions left on this that will, I think, drive these kind of very discreet and fairly isolated points home. So the first question is, which of the following is false? This is from your worksheet. Then the federal court, other than diversity cases, the standard for granting a new trial is if the size of the verdict shocks the conscience. B, in remitter, the plaintiff offers the plaintiff, or the court offers the plaintiff the option of taking less money or facing a new trial. C, an editor, the court offers the defendant option of taking less money or facing a new trial. Or D, in federal court, editor is unconstitutional, but remitter is constitutional. Which one of these is false? Which one of these is false? Go ahead and click in on this one with you and your partner. I'll give you 30 seconds on that one. Go ahead and click in if you haven't already. Let's see what we have this morning. All right, good. This one is C. The reason this one is wrong is that editor, the defendant, pays more. You should note this is unconstitutional in the federal system, but has not been rendered unconstitutional in every state. So you should understand what this is, because in some state courts, they still permit this, all right? But for our purposes, that's all I really want you to know about, what editor is, what remitter is, and you can't do editor in the federal courts. Okay, let's go to the next one. Here, this is about the last two grounds, 3 and 4, process for new evidence. Which of the following is not a valid basis to grant a new trial? Is it counsel, in Parsons v. Reckless, is it counsel for plaintiff, despite admonishments from the judge, repeatedly referred to the defendant as reckless by name and very reckless by nature. B, the judge omitted to instruct the jury that proof of causation was one element of negligence. C, that the judge allowed the plaintiff's expert to testify but now realized the expert was not qualified under Daubert, which we'll get to in evidence. D, newly discovered evidence shows that reckless suffered a heart attack and could not be negligent. Or E, the judge felt that based on the evidence, he would probably have decided the case the other way. Which one is not a valid basis on which to grant a new trial? Mm-hmm. Already got most people clicking in, so I'll just give you another 30 on this one. Okay, let's see what we have. Okay, very good. This one is E, that the judge felt that based on the evidence, he would have probably decided the case the other way. Why is that one wrong? It's kind of a misstatement of the last grounds we just talked about against the great weight of evidence. You never can just do, I think you should do this over, because, hey, I think you got it wrong, but more of the great weight of evidence. The rest of them are all examples of the other aspects, the process aspects and the new evidence aspects. And I don't see, the only one I have is like a few people on A, that reckless by name and very reckless by nature, that is inappropriate. You can't make disparaging comments about any party or any lawyer or any witness. A judge is not allowed to do any of those things in any case, and if they do that, you can get a new trial. Or at least you can argue for one, and if they don't give you one, because if a judge is going to call someone this, they likely will not give it to you, you can appeal that. All right. Let's go to the next stuff we have, which is 60, unless there's any questions at all, then remaining on new trial. Pretty much it was everything from last class, just those few last little things. Anything remaining on new trial? Okay, great. Let's talk about 60, which is the last post-trial motion we're going to talk about. We actually referred to this before when we talked about default judgments, if you remember, and I said, you know, we're going to get to this in the end. Here it is. And we're going to talk about how it works with default as well as it works with merit-based judgments. All right, so let's compare it to the new trial one. Who may file a motion under Rule 60? Plaintiff, defendant, or both? Both. So for all of these motions, it's been both parties. Who often moves for these things? Well, for new trial and for Rule 60 vacating the judgment, it's normally defendants and normally plaintiff. It's who lost. That's who's moving for these things. It's who lost. Okay? Can the court move for this? Yes. Now remember, new trial was totally sua sponte for the court. Rule 60, vacating the judgment, the court can sua sponte move for a 60A, a clerical error, but cannot move for 60B for anything else. It has to be a motion by a party. So there is some sua sponte ability of the court to do this, but only for clerical errors, only 60A. 59, new trial, court could do that on their own, okay? All right, the when parts, well, 60A refers to clerical errors, which should seem pretty obvious as far as examples. It's like wrong dockets, wrong documentation. You look at it, oh, we put the wrong name on who won the verdict. Jury said Parsons won. The judgment entry says, oh, reckless won. That would be a clerical error. Anytime you discover one of those is when you may file. So it's once it's discovered. So there's really not a limitation. In part because there's really no discretion here. You don't have to review anything. It's just, ooh, that's a typo. Okay? So you can pretty much do that. Anyone can do it, even the court, anytime that it's found. You would want to make sure you do it as quickly as you find it, but there's no limitation there. B is the other grounds, which are more like, they're called other grounds, but they're more centered around justice ideas, like equity ideas. And they are split into the two groups. The first is 1 through 3, the last 4 through 6. So they have different timing requirements. Both of them, you have to move within a reasonable time. Both of them within a reasonable time. Okay, both within a reasonable time. But 1 through 3, you have an outer limit. What's the outer limit? Does anyone know? Yeah. Yeah, no more than 1 year after the entry of judgment. So because these kinds of motions happen after the jury renders a verdict and the judgment's there, all of your timing on these ones are related to judgment. So you should kind of notice that from all of your rules, all the 28 days and 14 days and 1 year, these are all related to from the time of judgment entry. It's a good little kind of when in doubt, if it's a post-trial motion that you're talking about, say from the entry of judgment. Okay? Good. 4 through 6, there's no 1 year limitation on. It's just reasonable time. All right. Are there any prejudgment motions required? No. The only rule with prejudgment motions was judgment is a matter of law, that you had to make that first one and then you get the renewed judgment as a matter of law. Everything else doesn't require an initial judgment. And that's or initial motion. That should make sense. Because how would you know you're going to need a new trial? To be able to say, hey, ooh, I think I'm going to plant the seed for I want a new trial. Or I think I'm going to vacate this judgment when you don't know who wins. Okay, so we don't have any of those. It's just judgment as a matter of law that is the renewed one. All right, 60A grounds we already talked about are clerical errors, typos, and the like. 60B, I like to think of it as more like equity. The rules just say other grounds. It's like justice ideas. They are listed directly in the rule, but it's mistake, newly discovered evidence, fraud. that the judgment's void, it's already been satisfied or released in some way, or six, the catch-all, anything else. All right? Yeah.
So, like, you say, you always refer to it as, like, mistake. Uh-huh. And there, they have, like, mistake inadvertence for the exam is, like, mistake keyword. That
well, here's the nice thing about it. This is the one I only want you to know two and three on. Okay. So you can call number one whatever you want, because okay. I will not question you on
well,
that.
But, like, three, for instance, has, like, fraud misrepresentation.
I think they're all along the same lines as fraud.
Okay.
Yeah. So that I think that shorthand is fine.
Okay.
So for the two that we need to know, newly discovered evidence, number two, and three, fraud is a good way to kind of characterize it. Well, the reason why they use those other rules is that sometimes when you're using the substantive law to justify it, they call the same things different names. You'll notice that like in state law and common law and tort, sometimes we call this a particular type of claim, a particular type of defense. Misrep, fraud, it's all getting at the same thing. That there was some deceit on the court.
Newly discovered evidence is newly discovered evidence. We're going to talk about those two and how you prove it. If you want to flip to 862 and 863, when we go through the next hypo, you're going to use that. So just have it open, and we'll apply it. Since those are the only two I want you to know, I'll show you how the test works in the next hypo. Just have it open. 862, 863. 862-863. And let me tell you before we get there what happens. Remember, with new trial, we got a new trial. With 60, what we get is to set aside the judgment. So it's sort of like the do-over, but it's more impact. Why? Because the at this point, we have a finalized judgment that's been given some time at which we considered it final. If you are in a short period of time after the judgment has been rendered, you move for a new trial. It has the same effect of that judgment doesn't stand because we're redoing it, but it's different than vacating a judgment because you have to understand, for our litigation system to work, we have to give finality to judgments. If it can always be the, you know what, I didn't like what happened to me, I didn't think I got a fair shake, I want to redo it, we can never rely on the certainty of what the courts are doing. See that? I mean, you need to be able to plan for your life. I'm a defendant, reckless. Parsons is finally out of my life. I can move on. I can buy a house now. I can do whatever else I'm going to do that if I was facing litigation, I might not do. Corporations. I can invest in assets and tell people I'm free of these potential liabilities, right? So we need to have that point in time for finality. 60 is a threat to that because what you're doing is saying we're going to undo something we considered final. So how likely are we to do that, do you think? It's a threat to that. Not very likely. It's very, very... This is sort of the Hail Mary pass of litigation. In the end, when you're like, please, court, please just undo this judgment. So if you're early after the verdict's been rendered and the judgment's been entered, you move for a new trial because that you're more likely to get. It has the same effect if it won't be a final judgment against you and you can do the do-over. When you vacate, often what happens is there is refiling and you relitigate anyway. But it's a judgment we've all considered to be more final at this point, okay? That's actually why the B1 through 3s, we actually do set a year limit out. If you think about the mistake, newly discovered evidence, and fraud, how do you defend against that if you're more than a year out? If it's fraud, how are you going to find the witnesses and say, no, I didn't fraudulently do this, if it's like 5 years down the road? Or newly discovered evidence. At some point in time, we just have to say, you know, that's what this dispute was about. Anything else we find is no longer going to be used to impeach this judgment or used to vacate this judgment. And same with mistake, the same thing. If there's any kind of mistake, it's hard to defend it if you get a year out because what kind of evidence are you going to bring? You thought that was done. It's been done for a year. That's why those first three we even have a year limit to. Okay, so understand that there's a great force of you're not going to get this if you move for it in 60. Okay. So let's look through your last little basics that aren't in your reading, and then we'll do those hypos on 862 and 863. One thing I want you to do so you can put this with your notes, we talked about moving for 60B when you have a default judgment. The one exception to the idea of finality is default, because we didn't put any merits to it. You just didn't show up, so we gave them the judgment. So do you think we're going to be more likely or less likely to vacate a default judgment versus a merits judgment? Which one do you think we're going to be more likely to vacate? Default judgments or merits judgments? What do you think? Default. Definitely default. And this is the one where you typically see it work. It's the same standard. You know, you move for default.
You get the default judgment. You try and bake it in under 60. Even if you have a merits judgment, it's the same process, same standard. But you're more likely to win in default. Why? Because we haven't done anything. I put the process to it at all. You just didn't show up. All right. Another thing I find that students sometimes get confused about this because it's after trial, you actually make this motion to the trial court. Realize everything's done. Like they kind of close the case in their dockets. It's done. There's no more traffic on it. But that's who you have to go to for your relief because this is not an appeal. It's sort of like your last step before you go to an appeal if you think you can do it. Not everyone does this. This is not like we generally move for this. This is if you think you can fit it, you move for it. But generally you go to appeal. You can't. Okay? All right. So here's our hypos on those grounds. Let's presume that in the case we talked about new trial, the guy who had the jewels, remember him? Who was saying, oh, you know, you really owe me and the insurance company on these jewels because I had people rob me and they said, no, you never bought the jewels and you don't even have money to show you could have bought them. That guy. Let's presume he wins at trial. And the judgment is entered on day zero. On day three, Lloyd's of London, the insurance company, learns that robbers have just been arrested. But they turn out to be buddies of the Darians who confess that there were no jewels, it was all a setup job, and one of the friends got to shoot him. I don't know. All right, so the motion that you would file would be which one in this kind of circumstance? Is it a 60A motion, vacating the judgment for clerical error, 60B2, vacating the judgment for newly discovered evidence, C, Rule 59, new trial, D, Rule 50, judgment as a matter of law. Which one do you think it is? What's the best motion to file in this situation? So this is like an issue spotter question. Which one do you think it is? Okay, go ahead and click in if you haven't already. Helps me kind of know what you're thinking. What's the motion they should file? Ooh, no. It's C. It's C. Congratulations. I'm excited for you, too. I knew this one would be tricky. That's why I asked. I know why you're thinking 60B2. So there's a whole bunch of you in this camp. Why are you thinking 60B2?
Well, yeah. It's to test out what it's not. All right. So aside from, is that the only reason you clicked it? Because it said it at the top, 60 hypo? Anyone else give me a reason? Because I put it in here because I know it's what you generally tend to think of as 60, but it's not. Why else do you think so? It is. It fits along the lines of new evidence. Does it fit that standard? Yes, it does. And we're going to get to it in a moment. I'm going to change the hypo up, and it's going to turn into a real 60B2. Maybe even something else. But there's one fact here that actually makes it a motion for new trial. What is it? What do you got? Yeah. That's exactly it. Perfect. It's day three. It's early. You're still within the window. Remember how much time you had to file for new trial? I know it's yesterday. What? Remember?
No, this was after 1 year.
Yeah, after 1 year is 60. So this one's the quick one, remember? How much time do you have? What's our normal quick answer now? 20 days from the... That's right. So you got the when in doubt, 20 days from the entry of judgment. You may be wrong, but that's the general one that we tend to use these days. All right, so that's what it is, 28 days. So if you're within that 28 days, what do? You file for new trial. Why? I know you're thinking 60 sounds so much better. It's really not. 60 is the only one I have no other option kind of motion, because they're really against that. And you really are getting a release from the verdict because you're getting a new trial anyway. So you get the same impact, but the court is not, you know, the court doesn't go there unless it has to, and you shouldn't either. The real motion you should be filing is new trial. That's why I write it this way, because I know you're thinking, oh, it fits the standards under 60, so I'm going to move for it. It's just not the right way. We'll see it turn into one, though.
Mm-hmm. Is the reason why 50 is
not correct is because they couldn't have presented this evidence at the trial, so the court couldn't use it to determine.
Sort of. There's actually a lot of reasons why I think 50 doesn't work. One of the key ones is, in order to get a renewed motion for judgment as a matter of law, what would you have had to done first?
You'd have to do a pre-judgment motion, but...
And he didn't know about it. Remember? He just discovers on day 3 that there's these new robbers, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's your buddies. So could you have made that the basis for your motion as a judgment as a matter of law, even if you had filed a motion as a judgment as a matter of law?
No.
No, you couldn't have. So there's a couple reasons why it's out. You didn't file your initial motion, you can't do a renewed one after the judge. You just can't. Procedurally, you're done. That's why we allow these last sort of, like, stop gets. So it prevents people like this. Judgment as a matter of law is no longer available to you, because you couldn't have, you didn't even know about these people. How could you use that as the basis for your judgment as a matter of law? And secondly, it also probably wouldn't be such that we'd automatically fine for you necessarily. I think though that we're getting pretty darn close if we have people who are like in cahoots. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just from an issue-stopping perspective, if you already have a judgment, you would never look to judgment as a matter of law.
Well, you do for the renewed judgment as a matter of law.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think if like you're asking me, oh, well, we also see those post-trial, the 50B ones, the renewed ones, you should be issue-spotting for those post-judgment. But remember, they're tricky. They had to have that initial file of motion before it was submitted to the jury, remember? So you're already out. But not really, because you can get your new trial. And do you think you'd grant a new trial here? Remember the grounds for new trial we just covered? Okay, against the great weight of the evidence. It's not going to be that, because we didn't have the evidence before us. But remember, the other ones were basically the same grounds we're going to see under 60. One of them was newly discovered evidence. And this is the whole point. So you'd say, hey, this is newly discovered. Or procedural irregularity. The guy lied. Okay. Basically, the grounds are going to look about the same. About the same. There's a little bit more in 60, but for the purposes of what I'm asking, and no, they're about the same. All right, so that should be the right one. I already told you what we're going to do with this, and so you'll see 28 days is when it has to be filed by. You're going to see it turn into now. It should be a Rule 60 motion. But the nice part about the multiple choice question is that's your only option. So you can figure out which part of 60 do you actually think it is. First of all, I'll issue spot for you. Why is this one 60 now? What's the key fact that's changed? We're in day 90. Can you move for new trial now? Remember, it's 28 days with no extensions. We're past it. So that's how you do it. So I went in your notes, kind of in your timeline of motions. One thing you can do is tell yourself timing matters between new trial and 60. It matters. Okay, so let's go ahead and click in on this one. Which 60 motion would you have? Look at 862 and 863 to give you guidance. Okay. I'm going to give you like 20 seconds on this one now. Just go ahead and click in so we kind of know where you're at. It'll help me figure out how to tailor our discussion a bit. Go ahead and click in. Which one do you think is your thought at the moment? Which one do you think it is? Here, I'll pause it for just a second. We only have like 30. Go ahead and click in. This is your chance. Not all at once, you know. Thank you. Are they not working right now? Maybe not. I don't know. Oh, there is an F. That's probably the problem. All right, well, that's a really bogus clicker question now. I apologize, because that's actually the right answer. All right, well, it's F, which is not one of the options I clicked when I gave you the answer options. But let's talk about why it's right. Good thing it's the last day. All right, so it is C and D. So let's look at C and D. So for those who clicked in C and D when you're frustrated with your clicker, binge watch. 60B2, newly discovered evidence, the motion is due within a reasonable time within a year. There's two things that are right about the answer so far. It's that they've got the timing right, remember, reasonable time and the year window. The other part is the designation of the grounds. And 60B2 will fit for this, so will 60B3. Now, does it really matter then which one you pick? Not in this situation, because you're within a 1 and a 3. It would matter if, like, let's say you're a year out from the time, and you have 4 through 6, it would still be an opportunity. Remember, 1 through 3 would now be foreclosed for you. So it's more important to identify 1 through 3s versus 4 through 6s. What's the nice thing? I'm only making you know 2 and 3, so it's in the same group. All right, so here's how they work and how you would describe them. 2. 2 is newly discovered evidence, and the test is right there on 862 that even numbers it for you. Right, so let's talk about our situation and see how it fits. The evidence must be newly discovered since trial. Do we have newly discovered evidence? Okay, tell me yes and identify what it is in the exam. So what would the evidence be?
Say yes, there's newly discovered evidence. It is, insert your analysis here. What would it be?
Yeah, not all at once. Overwhelming the amount of coercive voices coming at you.
Yes, thank
you. It's Buddy's
confession. Yeah, the confession, the discovery of the robbers, any of that analysis would look great for me. Alright? Especially the confession part, because that's what's really linking it to he was fraudulent in his reports to the insurance company, which is really the issue at hand.
The second part, due diligence on the part of the move-in. Who's the move-in here? Lloyd's of London. To discover the new evidence must be shown. So,
we have no evidence to suggest that in any way they were kind of tipped off and just didn't do anything about it. But if, for example, I change the facts and say someone had called Lloyd's of London and said, you should look into Carl because he said he was a robber in this case and I know he's a buddy with the Darien. If we'd had evidence that they knew about it and just didn't pursue it, now they wouldn't be able to move for a vacation of judgment, okay, under newly discovered evidence. You can't just blind yourself to evidence and then later say, oh, I've newly discovered something after I lost. How convenient.
It's things that you really couldn't have known about. And I'm pretty sure Darien didn't disclose this in discovery. All right, 3. The evidence must not be merely cumulative or impeaching. So what do they mean? Let's take cumulative first. What you can't do under this one is someone who just says, well, I found more people that support me, and if you would have heard from 10 people as opposed to 5 people, I would have won. That's not what we're looking at. You had your chance. This isn't a chance to redo that. Impeaching. I've learned that other people are going to testify that he is a bias. The witness hates Lloyd's of London. Again, it might have impacted something, but it's not big enough now to get a vacation of judgment. It really has to be something beyond that. How is this beyond just cumulative evidence and beyond just impeachment? It surely will impeach the integrity of the Darien, right? Oh, yeah. But it's more than just impeaching his ability to be a witness. Why is it new and material evidence? Why is this new in a way that's not just like generic impeachment evidence? Yeah.
Because it's like he was actually found the robbers, so it can kind of tell if it's, you know, they can say like, oh yeah, we robbed him, we have the jewels, this is where the jewels are. It changes his story. It actually backs up his story and says that there were actually jewels and stuff. It's key to the case.
Except if they're fake robbers. They're gonna say, yeah, we didn't have jewels.
If they don't have the jewels, therefore
it backs up whose case?
Lloyd's case.
Yes, that's exactly what it's going to do. They're going to say, we didn't even know about the ability to attack the actual robbery. Remember what I'm sure they thought the robbery was false, right? But they didn't have any evidence to really attack that piece of it. What they attacked was, you never really bought the jewels, number one, and we couldn't find money that you could have used to buy those jewels, number two, and you lied to us about that. Now they could have made a whole nother attack on his claim and said, and you hired people to stage the robbery, which is even more evidence that this is a false claim to the insurance company. See? So it's not just cumulative, it's different in kind. What would be cumulative? Let's say it's one more bank teller who's going to say, and on the day he came to do the loan, it was really clear there was no money on that loan. That would be cumulative, right? Because we already had that kind of testimony. This is different in kind. It also has to be material. Well, the whole issue is, was he fraudulently creating a claim? if you hire robbers to pretend to rob you, then it's fraud. So it is material to the question of was he fraudulent. It's like the this is like the smoking gun, no pun intended, for this particular case, right? All right. 5. The evidence must be such that a new trial would probably result in a new result. Remember, they show Dedarian winning. That's what the jury said. Do you think if we were able to put the testimony on of the robbers, we might get a different result? I sure hope so. I mean, I don't know what's up with the first jury, but I'm sure hoping the second jury comes around. It's like, yeah, since his buddy's telling him we actually robbed him, then that should be a different result. So that's how you work through newly discovered evidence. Any questions on that at all? Just use those elements and work them through. Last one is fraud. Now, for that test, if you look above the box, the first FYI box in 863, it says the opposing party acted with an intent to deceive or defraud the court by means of a deliberately planned and carefully executed scheme. That's what it is. And that sort of just fits really well with the Dedarian case. It's deliberate intent to defraud the court. So it's motive. It's not just accidental misguidance or misstatement. It's an intentional deception. So hiring robbers and then hiding their identity is an intentional defrauding, right? Because we're really trying to obscure the claim. His claim is, I'm entitled to relief from the insurance company on my contract. He hired fake robbers. Intentionally defrauding the court. And then telling them, don't tell the court, right? Now. So that one's, I think, pretty easy to see. All right, so it ends up being both C and D. Now, that's the last I have on 60. Do you have any questions about 60 at all? Know all those basics. When you move, who can move, then what the impact on the case is going to be, and the grounds, and they're very similar to each other.
Just a question about the case in general. We were talking about it. It what happened on the remand?
I actually don't know. Look it up. I have no idea. I've never followed the Dedarian past here. I don't even know if it's reported, to be honest. Sometimes those ones actually don't. In fact, typical things like in district courts, most of them are non-reported cases. It's only where you see the appeal that you know. And I know that it's never been appealed again, but I never checked to see if the district court opinion was actually published. I don't know if it was published. Okay. And a lot of times, to be honest, what typically happens is because you don't really want to go through a new trial. Okay. Any other questions on 60? Let's do that last bit on jury trials. And truthfully, I don't anticipate this being anything with any significant weight whatsoever on the exam, but just want to show you kind of where your course is bringing you up to. So this is where I hand you off to other people. After we finish this, like, I mean, at most, there might be one more person at most. I would say I never cut anything out unless it was really bad, but don't fret over it. This course takes you up to two different ones, civil procedure jurisdiction and evidence. So this end of the course goes up to evidence, because you're going to start right here at evidence and say, okay, now you're in trial. Let's talk about the process in trial. Let's talk about what you're going to move into evidence, what you're going to exclude from evidence. We even look back at discovery a bit when you get to evidence. Jurisdiction is the precedent, essentially, before this course. You know, we've talked about when you've chosen to go into federal court, what happens in federal court, what's the process of the federal courts. All over the country, any federal court you choose will use the process we've discussed. But the how you get into the federal courts, can I go to the federal courts, can I go to the state courts, is jurisdiction. And so that's what you're going to take next semester. It's the course that comes sort of with a thought process before the federal courts. We teach it this way because first summer employment often wants you to know the rules as opposed to jurisdiction. And so it's a good kind of working model. And it's the same as Ohio for the most part. The federal rules are very similar. So even if you work in state systems, you'll have a good working knowledge. Jurisdiction won't be anything like rules, in part because there's no rules. It's all constitutional law for the most part and some statutory. So if you love con law, you're going to love jurisdiction. If you love like code and rules, you're going to be sad, you're going to miss them, but I'm sure most of you will get over it. So, all right, let's talk about the jury trial in federal court. So we'll walk you up to evidence where you need to go from there. All right, so we're just going to look at three key questions. When do you have a right to a jury trial? How do you ask for a jury trial? And the basic one, what is a jury? All right, so when do you have a right to a jury trial? This is a constitutional right under the Seventh Amendment. All right,
And the Seventh Amendment tells us, in suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved. So there's a couple words here that will limit the right. The first is suits at common law, or suits at law. And what we mean really is, there are suits that, when we used to have the separation of courts of equity and courts of law, they're the suits you could have filed in courts of law. All right, so what are those kind of suits? Like torts, some contract actions, some not. It really kind of depends upon the remedy you're looking for. A contract action for damages, court of law. A contract action for rescission of the contract, court of equity. And you actually had to pick which court you were going to go to. All right, these days, the courts have emerged since like 1938. And so you could file whatever kind of claim you wanted in the same court system, an equity claim or a legal claim. But the constitutional right is dependent upon, it had to be one that when you chose courts of law, it could go in a court of law. And secondly, the question or the word preserved is important because it means that the Seventh Amendment does not create new rights. It only keeps in place those jury trial rights that were present at this time. And so when is this? 1791. All right, so for all you history buffs, the answer for the modern cases is, what were they doing in the courts of law in England in the 18th century? That's really what the answer is. I know this is where the students get so excited. I'm just waiting for this historical part of the class. And here it is. And that's actually the modern test. So what's, if you have a jury trial right, if you had a right in courts of law in England in the 18th century, in 1771, would you have had, 1791, if you would have had a right to a jury trial, you have one now. So it's not future moving. But the problem is, for those cases that did exist, like negligence, there was a writ of negligence in the 18th century in England, and it was filed in the courts of law. That we know, you have a jury trial right too, because it was given a jury trial in those courts. But there's a lot more that becomes a problem, and that's when you have the situation where claims could now be filed in both courts, like a contract action, where you ask for rescission and damages as well. What do you do with that? And also, there's tons of new actions, new causes of action that are being created since 1791. And so what do we do with those? And the court, the Supreme Court told us in Chauffeurs what we do. So here's a hypothetical to kind of understand the tough cases. Let's assume that the federal Congress created a new cause of action for people who are injured by someone texting while driving. Probably not a claim you could have in 1791 for a variety of reasons. All right, so let's say Pam, our plaintiff, sues for her injuries and asks for money damages. Does she have a right to a jury trial? Well, one thing helps us figure this out. If Congress, when they create the cause of action, expressly says you have a right to jury trial, do you have a right to jury trial? If they say you have a right to jury trial, do you have a right to jury trial? They do. Do we have to go to the Seventh Amendment and ask whether or not there was texting while driving or the similarity to it in 1791? No, because the Constitution is preservation. It doesn't limit Congress's ability to create jury trial rights. They can always say, you have a right to jury trial in this new cause of action. And that's often what they do. So for most situations, it's actually not so hard because you look to the statute and say, did they create a jury trial right? They often do. You're done. Could Congress do the opposite, though? Could they deny a jury trial right? Well, let's say presumably for our claim, we can make an analogy to something that existed in 1791 and say there was a preserved right to jury. Could they say no rights to jury for this? Could they do that? We know in 1791, the corollary, there was a right to jury trial, but for text, there's no jury trial for you. Could they do that? No. Because it's a constitutional protection. Congress cannot just say, like, hey, you got no more First Amendment rights, you have no more Fourth Amendment rights. They can't do that. So same with jury trial rights. That's the idea of the Seventh Amendment, is it prohibits them from taking away something that's vested. The problem is where it's not clear that it's vested because either the statute stays silent or there's no corollary to the past. And I think our statute's a perfect example. Let's assume they don't say jury trial. How do we know whether this is something that we could say the Seventh Amendment actually protects? All right, so this is what you do. First thing you do is you have to identify what your claim is like that might fit the courts of law in 1791.
I know. It's ridiculous, but that's what you do. All right? So, I can guarantee you they didn't have any negligence actions while driving. And I can guarantee you they didn't have anything related to texting and that kind of thing. But my guess is they probably did have some basis of negligence, and I would say that's the closest fit. Now, somebody might say it's not, it's a particular type of it, and so that's what the dispute would be. Is it similar enough? The second thing you do is examine the remedy you're seeking and determine whether or not that remedy would be legal in the courts of law or equitable in the courts of equity. Okay, you want a jury trial, right? What should your argument sound like?
It's very similar to something in 1791. I know that sounds odd.
It's about texting, but it's so like what they did in the courts of England in the 18th century. And secondly, you want to argue everything is legal, meaning I have a legal claim, like the common law torts, contracts, those things, and I want legal remedies. What's a legal remedy? What's a legal remedy? The most one you always almost ask for? Damages. Damages. The problem is sometimes you get claims where you have a certain type of damage. Back pay. Is that really equitable or is that legal? Okay, it's for money, but it's more an equity if you think about it. It's trying to reinstitute what you were equitably entitled to. Back pay, they fired you for an improper purpose. That's really what chauffeurs was about. All right, so if you get the label equity, are you going to get a jury trial right? Don't want that. So every time, this is the one time you're arguing, this is all about damages. Remember, for class actions, damages made it more difficult. Now you want the label damages because you get the jury trial right. So that's what the dispute's really about.
How do you do this? I think it's sort of equivalent to asking, well, in which room at Monticello would Jefferson watch TV? All right, because you just don't know. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's sort of an obscure thing, and seeing this happen in court, it feels as odd as it sounds. And it's very, very difficult.
So in practice, I will tell you, what often happens is the philosophy of the judge as to the role of the jury will often dictate your results. And they will stretch to find things in equity if they don't want the jury trial right to be preserved, and they will stretch things to find a legal remedy if they want the right to be preserved. Yeah, quote me on that, but that's pretty much what's going to happen. So kind of know what your judge's position is like in these cases and try your best to argue for that. I think more judges are more inclined to give you jury trial rights because of its, you know, sort of sense of importance in our system of governance. That's not true of all countries, but we really do enjoy the jury trial right, so you're more likely to get it, but it is a really awkward debate. All right, so that's kind of the when you get it. The next thing is, how do you ask for it? That's rules 38 and 39, and I'll show you in these clicker questions one that I think is worthy of an exam question. So here's an easy one, hopefully. When do you get a jury trial? And I make sure I click all the way through D. Which one is the following best describes what Rule 38A stands for? A, 38A grants you a right to jury trial. B, the Seventh Amendment grants you a right to jury trial. And 38A merely refers to that grant. C, the Seventh Amendment or a federal statute grants you a right to jury trial. And Rule 38 merely gives you refers to that grant. Or D, 38A's grant is narrower than the constitutional grant to a jury trial. Which one do you think it is? Which one's the best answer? Uh-oh. Go ahead and click in on this one. Like 10 seconds here. Oh, it didn't go. All right. Okay, good. This one's C. That's the language. Make sure you've got the federal statute in there. That's the answer. Next one. How do you do it? Who can demand a jury trial right? Any party. It's not the court, but it's any party can do it. So it doesn't just have to be the plaintiff. The defendant can also demand a jury trial right. They just would have to say the plaintiff in a court of law would have gotten a legal remedy in 1791 could have gotten this. What form does it have to be in? It has to be written, but it's not a huge deal. Typically what happens is it appears on someone's complaint or their answer. It's right on the front page. You know, jury trial demand. Is that all you need to do? Yeah. Easy rule to comply with. But it has to be written. You can't go to court the first day or at the pretrial conference and be like, yeah, I'd really like a jury. You need to write it somewhere. Okay. When?
no later than 14 days after the last pleading on this issue.
So what it means is you can get a jury trial on even certain claims, certain issues, certain defenses. The last time anyone would have a responsive pleading on that particular issue, 14 days from there. So let's say the first thing we really want a trial on is the defense the defendant raises. Maybe they have a counterclaim. If they have a counterclaim, it's 14 days after my reply that either side could ask for a jury trial.
If you didn't put it on the front cover of your pleading, you just file a motion then, saying I request a jury trial. What do you do or what must you do with the demand? You have to serve it on the other party and file it with the court. It's why most people put it on their pleadings, because you automatically serve those to the other party and then file it with the court. So that's the easiest way to do it. Just write it on the cover of your pleading. All right. First hypo. Last of the easier ones. Go ahead and click in. So you should have this one on your worksheet. Plaintiff Parsons does not want a jury trial, and so doesn't request one, but defendant Reckless writes jury trial demanded on all issues on the front of his timely filed answer. The answer is served and filed, which is true. Which is true. A, defendant Reckless is not entitled to a jury trial because the plaintiff does not want one, and plaintiff's choice as the master of the case prevails. B, defendant Reckless is entitled to jury trial because only defendants are entitled to demand jury trials. C, the demand is valid even though it's written on the front of the answer. D, the demand is invalid because it's untimely under the rules. Go ahead and click in on this one. Click in on this one. Should have this one, so I'm just going to give you a few more seconds to answer this one. Okay, C is correct. Now we're at time, so I'll just give you the answers to the last ones and I'll post them. But here's my notes. I'll post the notes to these ones and post them for you. As far as the answers for these ones go, hypo 2 is B. But the one I really want you to look at is hypo 3, which the answer is A. And now that one, the reason I want you to look at it, and like I said, I'll post my answers on Twine with an explanation for it, is I think as far as style goes, for any topic, not just jury trials, this is a good example of a multiple choice question. Why? It has two rules you have to know within the answer, and so I'm testing out more than one issue. These are kind of the best ones, these as examples. All right. Like I said, I'll just post these. The last thing I was just going to let you know is as we get up to the exam, and I'll also summarize this for you on TWEN, but on Tuesday, April 26th, so this coming Tuesday, from 1 to 2 p.m., I reserved our classroom for an optional review. You do not have to come, but I encourage you to. I'll answer any questions about coverage of the exam at that time and any questions you have that are posted on TWEN by noon of that day, or given to me by email as of noon of that day. I originally set up until Friday today, I would accept answers on TWEN to hypo questions. I know people have told me they really wanted to do this and ran out of time, so I'm giving you the weekend. So Monday, April 25th at noon on TWEN, for the first 5 questions to any hypo that's been posted on a slide or anything I've given you, I'll answer those. Office hours, I'll be posting a sign-up sheet, and then TWEN an email. My cutoff for answering questions is 6 p.m. the day before, in part because I find that it's just nerve-wracking for you, and other people don't want to have to look at TWEN to see if they've missed something, so that's the cutoff date. And I will give you a posting on the actual instructions of the exam as well. All right? Thanks a lot. And I'll post these last ones on TWEN for you.
The material that we didn't talk about in class, you're going to post
it. I'll post the answers and everything.
Okay.
And don't worry about it.